Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming all this way out to ScienceWorks. My name is Tanya Hill, and I'm the astronomer for the new Melbourne Planetarium that you'll be seeing a sneak preview of later this evening. There are actually four of us on the planetarium team, and throughout the evening, well, when we do the sneak preview of the planetarium, I'm sure you get a chance to meet the other three members in the planetarium team. But first off this evening, we're having a lecture by Professor Martin Harwit. He's visiting Australia from Cornell University, and he's actually doing quite a whirlwind tour of Australia, has visited Sydney and Canberra, is now in Melbourne, and is going back to Sydney later on in the week. Professor Harwit is actually quite familiar with museums. He was the director of the National Air and Space Museum at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington for almost 9 years, and it's been a pleasure actually taking him through and showing him the ScienceWorks Museum here in Melbourne. So tonight, Professor Martin's going to talk about the new adventures in infrared astronomy, which is actually particularly dear to my own heart because my PhD project is actually on infrared astronomy, so I quite look forward to Professor Martin's lecture. Please make him welcome.
Well, good evening and thank you for coming. I'm going to be talking about infrared astronomy tonight, which has made great advances in the last few years, particularly because we've been able to go into space and get a clear view of the universe. Here you see a view that the Hubble telescope has taken, a picture that the Hubble Space Telescope has obtained at optical wavelength, visible light, and there are a large number of galaxies here, far more than you would see in the local galaxy, because you're looking very, very far back in time, and around here you see a lot of very faint but very blue galaxies. You see how blue this one is and this one compared to the yellow ones that are nearby. What we're seeing here is a very, very early time in the galaxy, in the background. The foreground are galaxies just like ours, made up of 100 billion stars, perhaps, just like the Sun. But in the background, you see these very blue, but very faint, because they're so far away, galaxies. And they are not quite as big as ours yet, perhaps something like one-tenth the size, maybe one-hundredth the size. Many of those are going to be merging to become larger and larger galaxies as time goes on. As we look out into the universe, we see these faint, small blue galaxies as they were about 10 billion years ago, whereas the foreground ones are seen almost at the present time, maybe a few hundred million years ago. What we also see in these faint blue galaxies are stars that are made up essentially of pure hydrogen and helium. The metals like iron and gold and zinc are going to come later. They get cooked in the centers of stars as hydrogen is first converted into helium, and then the helium is converted into carbon and oxygen and neon and magnesium, and eventually iron and the heavy elements like uranium. All of that happens at the center of stars, and then if some of these stars are very massive and they explode, they throw these heavy chemical elements out into the universe. And so what you're looking at as you look back in time are very young stars making small galaxies, making up small galaxies with maybe a billion stars in them instead of the 100 billion stars that we see in our own Milky Way today. And they're very rich in hydrogen and helium and still very poor in metals. Maybe only 1% of the heavier elements like carbon, iron, zinc, manganese are there compared to the levels, the concentrations that we have here today. Now, these stars also And these galaxies also put out heat. And one of the tasks of infrared astronomy is to sense that heat. You need photographic plates or charge-coupled devices in order to see visible light. For the infrared, you have heat sensors of a very different kind. And so you need to have special detectors and special telescopes to be able to make these infrared or heat sensing observations. It's these that I'm going to be talking about today. They allow you to see the heat that's emitted by objects, galaxies, stars out in the universe, and they also allow you to do chemical analyses to see what sort of molecules, what sort of heavy elements might be there. Now, to make infrared observations, you can't look through the atmosphere. You can't work from mountaintops. If you look at the lowest panel here, you can see that even at the highest observatories, you're looking at long wavelengths. And this is a scale here in so-called microns, where 1 micron is about twice the wavelength of visible light. So if you're looking at 100 microns, you're looking at 200 times longer wavelengths than the wavelength to which the eye is sensitive. You need special equipment for that. But also, what is shown here is how much atmospheric obscuration has to be gone through. At 10 microns, you can work fairly well from the ground. Also at 2 microns over here, you can work fairly well from the ground. But between 20 microns, or 40 times the wavelength to which light is sensitive, the eye is sensitive, and about wavelengths of about a millimeter, which almost is the wavelength of radio waves, you can not even see through the atmosphere at altitudes as high as a mountain. It's all obscured, fogged in. You can go up in airplanes and fly over most of the water vapor that and carbon dioxide, primarily water vapor, that obscures the radiation coming in from the universe, absorbs it, and doesn't allow it to pass through. And at balloon altitudes, it also do very well. But to really do extremely well, you have to go out in rockets. Rocket flights don't last very long. So your best bet is to build a telescope that you can mount in a satellite. And then you have a really clear view out into the universe. You don't have to worry about water vapor absorption or atmospheric absorption of any other kind. Here, instead of plotting wavelengths, I'm talking about far infrared, which is at about several hundred times the wavelength of visible light. Near infrared, which might be maybe 5 times the wavelength of visible light. Visible light here, and ultraviolet, which the eye can't see either. Ultraviolet represents bodies that are heated to about 10,000 degrees above absolute temperature, much hotter than the surface of the sun, as hot as some of the bright blue stars that we see in the sky, and also as hot as some of those blue galaxies that we saw. At 1,000 degrees Kelvin, which is about as hot as you're going to get a stove, an electric, when you turn the electric stove up for cooking as high as you possibly can, and it glows white hot, which it usually doesn't do, then you get to about 1,000 degrees. Sort of reddish yellowish will be about 1,000 degrees, but very cold is about the temperature of dry ice, carbon dioxide that's frozen, and you've all seen dry ice for cooling off beer in the summer and things like that. So in order to detect the heat given off by dry ice, you have to work out pretty much in the far infrared at wavelengths that are about 100 times the wavelength that to which visible light is sensitive. And much of the dust and the gas between stars in the universe is at about this temperature, or even lower. I'll come to that in a minute. And so then you need, in order to be able to see that effectively and analyze it chemically, you need to have infrared equipment that will correspond to the and respond to those temperatures. Over a period of about 15 years from 1985 on, the European Space Agency, with some help from NASA in the United States and from ISAS, the Japanese agency, but primarily the European Space Agency, built this infrared space observatory called ISO, for short, which orbits the Earth way out to 70,000 kilometers and comes plummeting back down to an elevation about 1,000 kilometers and goes back out again. Does that every 24 hours. And it did that for about 28 months. It was filled with liquid helium, which was pumped down to a temperature only 2 degrees above absolute zero. And it had to be at that temperature so that the telescope itself would not emit more infrared radiation than we would be receiving from the universe. Because otherwise, if the telescope had been at room temperature, all the detectors and sensors would have been blinded by the emission given off by the telescope itself. So you have to have an extremely cold telescope in order to be able to see wavelength that of something like a couple of hundred times the wavelength of light, visible light, at 100 microns. This telescope weighed about 2.4 tons, contained 2,000 liters of liquid helium pumped, and had a telescope which is quite small, actually. It's only about 60 centimeters in diameter, about as far as the two hands I have are apart. This big, which is very small. An amateur telescope is about that size sometimes, about 24 inches. So because the wavelength is so long, at 200 microns, which is the maximum wavelength, or 400 times the wavelength to which the eye is sensitive, one didn't get a very clear picture. You need to have a very big telescope for a long wavelength in order to be able to see the sky clearly. It's sort of like the human eye is too small to separate the Milky Way out into its component stars. You need a big telescope to be able to do that. Even if you have good eyesight, you don't do that. A camera with maybe a couple of inches across or 5 centimeters may be able to resolve the Milky Way into its component stars, but it won't really be able to see very much detail in some of the nebulosity that we see out in with a big telescope. So the larger the telescope, the clearer the image that you get, the better the spatial resolution, the better the quality of the picture. Inside the telescope, there's a cutaway here. The radiation comes in, the infrared radiation comes in. It's reflected off this primary Cassegrain mirror, which is only 60 centimeters across. It comes to a secondary mirror, comes down, and now is divided into four components that go to four different instruments. One is a near-infrared camera that takes pictures at wavelength that are something between about 5 and 30 times the wavelength to which visible the eye is sensitive, or 5 microns to 15 microns. Then there's a spectrometer, which is sensitive in the near-infrared, which divides the light coming into its component wavelength or colors in infrared colors, not colors that the eye would see. And then the corresponding detectors also for the very long wavelengths that are out at 100 and 200 microns, or 200 to 400 times the light to which the eye is sensitive. With a camera, one was able to get this rather nice picture of the galaxy Messier 51, which has these two components, the larger galaxy and then a secondary galaxy attached to it. This is the clearest picture that has ever been obtained in the infrared of this particular galaxy, showing clearly its spiral arms. What is radiating in, and what you see in that infrared picture, are not the stars that you would see radiating in a photograph, or that you would see with a naked eye, but rather it's dust clouds like this, which here are seen against a background of stars in our own galaxy, in the Milky Way, which is sort of sees a has a patchwork of these dusty, almost factory-type smoke, very tiny particles that obscure the radiation from background stars, as you can see here, and look very black. This one here is called Barnard 86. It's one of the objects that an astronomer earlier in the century by the name of Barnard cataloged, and this is the 86th object in that catalog. It's these dust clouds that get heated up by adjacent stars or stars that are embedded in them, and the dust then is nowhere near as hot as the stars are themselves, because the dust is quite far away from the stars, so it absorbs only a fraction of the stellar emission. So it might be of the order of the temperature of dry ice, but with a sensitive infrared telescope, you're able to see that. And let me show you how that looks then. There was an earlier satellite in the early 1980s that was launched by the United States with help from Britain and the Netherlands, called the Infrared Astronomical Satellite, called IRAS. And here is sort of a very crude picture, but an important one, because it was the first one that we had of the Milky Way, taken at wavelength of 12 microns, or about 25 times visible light. And you see now this, the fine lines in this rectangle that I'm showing you here, where there's almost nothing to be seen. Well, with the infrared space observatory, this is the view that we got of that rectangle. And you can see that you see all kinds of bright patches here, stars that are embedded inside that region where you saw nothing before, because it's obscured by dust. The dust is so thick that you don't see through it with visible light. But an advantage of infrared radiation is that its wavelength is longer than the size of the dust grains. And so the dust has a difficult time absorbing that kind of long wavelength radiation. It's a little bit like a radio antenna. A radio antenna has to be matched to the wavelength of the radiation. So if your radiation is maybe a meter in the wavelength, the waves are sort of a meter in periodicity, then the antenna has to be about a meter in size. If it's much smaller than that, it won't absorb the radio or emit the radio wavelengths. Same thing in the infrared. If the dust is smaller, it turns out the dust is approximately the size of visible light wavelength. So it absorbs visible light very, very strongly, but the infrared radiation can pass through almost unattenuated, particularly at the longest infrared wavelengths. And so this is a nice way to look into these deep clouds, these dark clouds, and that's important because this is where stars are being formed. The dust clouds are quite cool, as I mentioned to you, and so under their own gravitation they begin to contract. There's nothing to keep them from falling into each other from their own gravity. So they keep contracting until they form stars, and then once they form stars, they no longer contract any further. So in order to see where these young stars are forming inside this cocoon of dust, which visible light cannot penetrate to follow that formation of stars. We never knew how stars really form until we had infrared telescopes that allowed one to look into these clouds, more or less like a physician will look into you with X-rays and can see your innards and see what's going on there. And that's exactly what the infrared permits you to do, and what the Infrared Space Observatory allowed us to do over the last 5 years or so. Here, one is looking into another dark cloud, which is called the Rho Ophiuchus cloud. And what you see here is an image in false color. That is, the bluish hues are actually at wavelength from 5 to 8.5 microns, roughly 10 to 15 times the wavelength of visible light. The yellows are wavelengths of 12 to 18 microns, about twice that length. And so the more yellow it is, the colder the gas is, and the bluer it is, the hotter it is. And here you're looking at a cloud which in visible light would just be totally black, but here you're looking into it and seeing faint stars forming. These are not factory chimneys belching out smoke. It's just the edge of the detector here that has a funny sort of a gap. So don't let that confuse you. Now, there's another cloud at which one looked, which is called the chameleon cloud. And again, the infrared camera was able to look into that and plot the distribution of numbers of stars, 25, 20, 15, and so on, that emit a certain amount of light, which now is shown in logarithmic form, which is shouldn't confuse you. Where it says 0, that's the brightness of the sun. Where it says -1, it's 10 times less bright than or luminous than the sun. Where it says -2, it's 100 times less luminous than the sun. And notice that in this cloud, we are getting stars in large numbers, which are between 100 or at the faintest 1/300th the luminosity of the sun. They only put out 300 times less radiation than the sun, or rather, once they become stars, this is actually the luminosity that they will be having. Right now, they're not stars yet, but many of these will develop. The lowest luminosity ones will develop into what are called brown dwarfs. Brown dwarfs are not really standard stars. They're much smaller in mass than a regular star is, like the sun. Their total mass may be something like maybe 1/30th the mass of the sun. And they're different in that they're able to exist without collapsing further for quite different reasons than planets do or the sun does. Have you ever thought about what keeps the Earth from collapsing under its own gravity? Well, it's that the compression, that atoms don't like to be compressed, and there's a huge pressure at the center of the Earth trying to crunch it into ever smaller volumes. But atoms, once you compress them a certain amount, say enough, we're not going to let you compress any further. And so the Earth doesn't sort of keep shrinking under its own gravity and collapsing, it just stays there. And its present size is always going to be that same size, pretty much. In a brown dwarf, there's more material, and at some point, the overhead pressure from all of that mass overcomes the repulsive forces of the atoms and the electrons inside the atoms. It actually squeezes the electrons out of the atoms like you'd squeeze water out of a wet rag. And these atoms then are the electrons that are squeezed out. Now, are not able to expand enough, and the only thing that they can do, they don't like to be squeezed together indefinitely. There's something called the Pauli principle, which doesn't allow two electrons to have exactly the same location or to be very close to each other unless one of them is much hotter than the other. So what happens is you drive up the temperature of the electrons, and eventually the pressure of that very high temperature electron gas keeps that Brand dwarf from collapsing. For a star, even that electron pressure isn't enough. And so if you get as much mass as the Sun has, then the only thing that keeps the Sun from collapsing is that it gets so hot in the center that nuclear reactions take place, and these nuclear reactions then are able to form helium out of hydrogen. And it's so hot in there that these reactions take place, and they keep this, they provide enough energy that they can keep the interior hot, even though much of that energy escapes from the surface of the Sun. So there are three different types of things. Types like the Earth and Jupiter are sufficiently small that they exist by virtue of these atomic repulsive forces. The Brown dwarfs, which are a new class of stars that hadn't been seen until maybe 3-4 years ago, but whose birth we are now witnessing in the infrared, are the ones that are held apart and kept finite size by this electron pressure. And then there are things like the stars, which we've known about for centuries, which are like the Sun, and which have these nuclear reactions taking place in their centers. The Brown dwarfs do not. Okay. Now, I told you that we have some spectrometers on board this infrared telescope which divide the radiation into its different wavelengths or colors. Wavelengths are just colors. And when you do that, you get different intensities of light at different wavelengths. And so if you plot that, you get a so-called spectrum, which is a signature. And that signature tells us what the chemical composition of this particular cold dust cloud is. And what you see here is, this part here is the signature of frozen water, ice. Okay. This one here is the signature of frozen carbon dioxide. And this one here is the signature, this little blip is the signature of frozen methanol or wood alcohol. And then carbon monoxide, frozen, that gives a blip right here, and methane, or the kind of gas you use for cooking, gives this blip here. So you know this is carbon dioxide, for example, because there's also a second blip up here in the upper right-hand corner. And this here is a very broad feature which one sees almost everywhere in the dust that occupies the spaces between the stars. These are silicates. That's just sort of sand like you have it on the beach. So you see there's a rich chemistry here that we're able to identify by having sensitive infrared equipment that not only can detect the radiation from these dust clouds, but can divide it into its component colors and tell you what the chemical species are that we're observing there. When you have carbon monoxide frozen, you know that the temperature has to be less than 25 degrees above absolute zero, because otherwise the carbon monoxide would no longer be frozen. It would sublime, and you would see a quite different spectrum, which is a spectrum, or quite different signature, which is the signature of gaseous carbon monoxide, which is very different from the signature it has when it is in frozen form. Not only can you see that the dust is, that the carbon monoxide is frozen and the carbon dioxide is frozen, but you notice here it says polar and apolar on the left-hand side of in the first column, both for the carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide. And it tells you what the abundance of these features is. Well, polar means that the carbon monoxide has been absorbed by water crystals, ice crystals of water, and both the carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide are fairly abundant in their admixtures of water. And the apolar means that these frozen gases are on their own you see crystals of them in interstellar space, which are not admixed with water. And we know all this because in the laboratory we've been able to simulate this. Chemists have been able to work at very low temperatures that are only a few degrees above absolute zero. In the laboratory, they freeze out these substances and all kinds of mixtures of different substances, and then put together a catalog of what these different signatures would look like. And so we know, for example, what carbon monoxide looks by itself, what water vapor looks like by itself, what the mixture between the two of them looks like when you have them frozen together in one dust grain. And so we are able to make these chemical analyses because we've looked at these things in the laboratory and we recognize exactly the same sort of features out in the universe. Here is the Hubble Space Telescope. And in the last couple of years, it also has had a near infrared camera on board, and that has looked at wavelength around 2 microns, which are only perhaps 4 times the wavelength of visible light. And what you see here are, particularly in the lower right-hand corner, you see sort of two features, which let me see if I can focus this a bit better. Yeah, two features look sort of orangish here in false color, and a very dark band across them. Well, this is a solar system in the stage of formation. This is what our own solar system looked like perhaps 10 billion years ago when the sun was formed, and it was surrounded by a huge disk of gas and dust. And the dust in here, even in the near infrared, at wavelengths only 4 times that of those to which the eye is sensitive, is sufficiently absorbed in this very thick disk of dust that we see no light penetration through at all. But that's a very flattened disk. It's about 200 astronomical units across, which is about twice the distance of Neptune, or 3 times the distance of Neptune from the Sun. And it's about 50 astronomical units, or roughly the distance to Uranus or Neptune wide. And what you see here is light coming through. This is a flattened disk, so the light can come out, the infrared radiation come out at the top and the bottom of the disk, but it can't come through it, and we're seeing it edge on here. And there are a number of these systems here, of which this one is the clearest one, that all represent very young stellar systems with dust surrounding them still. These have just been discovered in the last year. Now, when you look at a very young star like the ones that I've shown you before, and this one is called HD 100546, doesn't tell you very much, but that's its catalog number, you notice that it has a number of features right here and here and particularly here and here that are very similar to the comet Hale-Bopp, which was around a couple of years ago. And when you look in the laboratory and compare comet Hale-Bopp to a laboratory spectrum that the chemists have taken, you find that you have exactly the same features in common between comet Hale-Bopp and a mineral called fosterite, which is an olivine mineral, which is a silicate again, just like sand is, but it's a particular silicate which is rich in magnesium. Let me go back, and here you see this so-called these features that I've marked here, all the fosterite features. What this is telling you is that this young star is surrounded by dust, which is very similar to the dust that we find in comets. And comets are believed to be the oldest inhabitants, representing the earliest form of matter that existed in the solar system. Comets and matter from comets kept colliding at that time, And presumably the terrestrial planets in particular, but also some of the outer planets, were formed from cometary material about 5 billion years ago, and slowly the Earth formed, took shape 4 billion years ago, and then 500 million or 4.5 billion years ago, and then this is just about the time, maybe 500 million years after the Sun had formed. And so the Sun formed 5 billion years ago. I think I may have made a mistake and said 10 earlier. It's really 5. So what we're seeing here is a nice picture. We always thought in the last 20 years or so that comets formed very early and represent the remnants of material that was formed very early in the life of the solar system. And here we're getting confirmation of a star that's just forming now that has this disk of comet-like material around it. And so we say, okay, we see in that system a star which is just like the Sun was 5 billion years ago at the time that the planets were being formed. And so by looking at what we see today and looking at what we saw, what we see, looking in other systems that mimic what the Sun may have been like earlier, we're able to get a history, piece together a history of what, how stars form, how planets form, what they form from, what the substances are that exist at the time of star and planet formation. And we're beginning to sort of put together coherent pictures. We're certainly very far still from certainty about all kinds of things, but the rough outlines seem to be coming into focus. Now here we're looking at another young object, so-called Herbig-Haro object, which is like the ones that I showed you before, except that rather than having a disk and patches of things coming out, they're actually jets that are jutting out in both above the disk and below the disk and reaching way out into interstellar space. And the material is being thrown out with supersonic velocities. And it, if you look at these jets, what you're finding is that there's a lot of water. This is again a spectrum or a signature, chemical signature of these jets. And we see carbon monoxide in there, and we see a lot of water, water vapor. Now, not frozen water. And this has been particularly important and perhaps one of the great successes of this infrared space observatory, because until we were able to take spectrometers above the atmosphere in a satellite, we never were able to see these. The atmosphere is so strongly absorbing of anything that's got water, any of these water vapor features, because the water vapor within the atmosphere blots out what's coming in from much further away, that we never were able to see this. And now all of a sudden we're able to see the chemistry that's going on here. And also this water vapor is very good at absorbing heat and radiating it away. And so it's a coolant that allows some of these dust clouds to emit energy. As they're contracting, they would normally heat up and then stop contracting under their own gravity because they'd be too hot and the heat would keep the molecules and atoms jiggling around. But if you can radiate away energy, which hydrogen is very poor at doing, pure hydrogen, if you put an admixture of water vapor and carbon monoxide in, all of a sudden these impurities are able to radiate away energy and allow the slow contraction of this material, radiating away the heat of contraction and allowing stars to form. What we don't understand is how stars formed in the very earliest universe when these heavy chemical elements did not yet exist. We didn't have any oxygen, we didn't have any carbon, so we couldn't have water or carbon monoxide. So when you take that view that the Hubble Space Telescope gave us in the very first slide, where you see these blue little galaxies, we don't really know exactly how those first generation of stars formed, because there wasn't any oxygen there and there wasn't any carbon there to allow the cooling of those clouds, and the actual cooling by hydrogen would be a very slow, ponderous thing, and somehow it must have happened. We're not quite sure yet how. Now, the Orion Nebula, which is actually still visible in the sky, there's a little pinkish star-like object in the Sword of Orion, in the middle star of the Sword of Orion, is the Orion Nebula. And when the Infrared Space Observatory looked at that, let me go back, it saw this very complex spectrum. Every feature in here has been identified. The orange lines indicate all the emission by molecular hydrogen. The blue features are all the atomic hydrogen. The green features down here are all ionized atoms, which means atoms out of which the electrons have been torn. So those are very hot regions, hot enough so that the electrons get torn out of the atoms. And the yellow ones are the frozen substances. So what you're seeing here is, in this view, there's a hodgepodge of all kinds of regions, some terribly, terribly cold, so that the carbon monoxide is still frozen, others terribly hot, so that the electrons get torn out of the atoms, and then molecules and atoms in regions that are in between. A few years ago, a telescope called the Cosmic Background Explorer was launched, which produced a map of the background radiation of the sky. It produced it at wavelength of 100, 140, and 240 microns, or the longest wavelength was about 500 times the wavelength to which light, the eye is sensitive, and it obtained an all-sky view, which looked sort of like this. Here is the Milky Way plane, and it's sort of a wrap around. It looks instead of looking round, it's egg-shaped because if you were looking right at the center of it, then the two edges would wrap around the back of your head, and that's how you have to think of it. And here you have a mixture of these different wavelengths. And you notice that you have the Milky Way very bright, and then you also have this band here, which is the remnant dust we still have in the ecliptic plane, or the plane of the planets, that the remnant dust, which is always slowly spiraling in the sun and has been around ever since the early formation of the solar system. And it's dust that's emitted by comets that come too close to the sun. And it's dust also that's produced when asteroids, the smallest of the planets, collide. Now, that dust gives off heat at 10 microns, twice 20 times the wavelength of visible light. And in addition to that, the plane of the galaxy gives off radiation at 200 times the wavelength of light, or 100 microns. And if you subtract that out, here again you have the observed sky. The blue part here is now radiation at about 10 microns from the zodiacal dust, the dust in the solar system. This is the dust in the Milky Way plane. Here you've removed the zodiacal dust. You're just left with the dust in the Milky Way plane. And here they've removed most of that. And what's left now is radiation coming in from outside the galaxy, and from the distant universe. And you really would like to know what this is, where this all comes from. So, and the spectrum of that, again going from the visible part around here at half a micron, all the way out to, on the far right here, the millimeter wavelength range, is roughly given with a peak here, maybe in the middle at 100 microns. This is still not very well established. There's a range of values here, as you can see, shown by these red lines, which shows our uncertainty. But we know more now about this, at least, than we did about a year ago when this first was published. what one is wondering about is where this infrared radiation comes from, and the idea is that perhaps some of it comes from galaxies that have formed about 15 billion years ago, right down here at the bottom, because that's the earliest time when dust could have been formed, because before that there wasn't any oxygen, there wasn't any carbon, there wasn't any silicon out of which the silicates could have been constructed. And so one thinks that by looking back in time, we will be seeing the very first formation of dust, the very first formation of these heavy elements. And to see whether this is the case, a number of us started looking and mapping the sky with this infrared space observatory to see whether the galaxies that we see emitting infrared radiation could, between them, give off as much radiation as one sees in the background radiation. So this satellite that measured the background radiation didn't really have a good mapping scale. It just sort of took in radiation from very large areas. Here we have a good telescope that allows us to identify individual spots. And maybe this could be just a lot of junk, you might think, that a bad detector makes you think are real. But actually, there are a number of features here in the lower right-hand corner of this map that you also see it at a longer wavelength. This is at about 5 to 8.5 microns. The next map is 12 to 18, and you see the same feature down here. In a deeper map, still, you see a number of features like this, and this one here is taken at 5 to 8 microns. We also did it at 12 microns. And what I've shown here is to give you confidence that these galaxies are all emitting, even though they're very faint, in the infrared. I've put together a superposition of two images. One in the blue one represents the radiation at about 5 to 8.5 microns, the red one at 12 to 18, and I've displaced the blue one relative to the red, sort of diagonally upwards to the right, in order to show to separate them a little bit. And you can see in the middle here that there's a real correspondence between individual blue spots and red spots that are displaced from there. So there's no doubt that what we're seeing here are really very deep images. Now, when you sum up all the radiation from these sources, you find that you're only seeing about 10 or 20% of the radiation in the background. So we have to ask ourselves, where does the rest come from? Well, I've told you that we only had a 60-centimeter telescope here, and so there may be a lot of fainter sources that are kind of merging into a blur because we don't have a big enough telescope to separate them out into the individual galaxies, and they together might be contributing 5 to 10 times as much as what we are seeing here in the nearby brighter sources. So we're hoping that by building bigger telescopes in the next few years, we're going to be able to sum up the energy that's given off by these and then also be able to tell something about the total amount of radiation given off by these galaxies. We're going to be able to use the chemical analyses of them to also determine their redshift, that is the speed with which they're moving away from us, which is an indication of the age at which in the universe at which they were formed. And so we're going to be able to tell when the radiation was generated in the universe that we actually received today. Now, as a final note, I should tell you that what we're trying to do in parallel is also not only to measure this radiation that's emitted in the infrared, but also to analyze the heavy element content of these very distant sources so that we can follow not only the evolution of stars and of galaxies and see how brightly they shone at different times, but we also know that the brighter they shine, the more rapidly they're forming chemical elements. And we want to make sure that that understanding which we have now about how the elements are formed and when they are formed in the life of the universe, that we're really correct about this. So what we want to do is to look back in time and see both how bright the galaxies were at different epochs in the evolution of the universe, and correspondingly how many chemical elements they were churning out at the same time, because the brighter they are, the faster they are producing chemical elements. If we can get that picture to properly jibe, then we will start to feel that we're really beginning to understand the motivation of the universe at these relatively recent times, that still is not going back further than about 15 billion years ago. Most of what we would be seeing here would still already be about a billion years old, or maybe at least 500 million years old. But we're getting there. Thank you.